Welcome to Countersign. This is Stuart Motha. Countersign is a podcast where we discuss books, films, and other materials. In this, its third series, we will focus on conversations that treat the problem of the environment, climate change, and mass extinction. You can catch up on previous series wherever you get your podcasts or on countersignisapodcast.com. Professor William E. Connolly is Krieger Eisenhower Professor in the Department of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. His work spans many decades. I've been reading his books since the early 1990s, and most recently, he's turned his attention to climate change with a vigor that I've not seen in any other scholar. There are further introductory remarks that I make at the beginning of my discussion with Professor Connolly. But for now, I just want to outline the broad contours of our conversation. Connolly is deeply concerned with what he refers to as climate casualism, which stems from a sense that the Earth's climate changes gradually. He emphasizes that there is a volatility with planetary climate that is not sufficiently recognized by political and juridical actors. After setting out why an appreciation of planetary volatility is central to how we address challenges posed by the Anthropocene, we move to discuss Connolly's main intellectual interlocutors. He sets out Deleuze and Guattari's schema of major and minor traditions in explaining how he moves to draw on pagan thinking. Connolly warns of the dangers of sociocentric thinking, where social issues and problems are erroneously thought to be anchored in some other social process rather than in the complex human, non-human processes that determine both human and non-human existence. The range of political philosophers and thinkers in the minor tradition that Connolly engages and we discuss is vast. We move through Sophocles, Lucretius, Mary Shelley, Michel Foucault, Whitehead, Amitav Ghosh, Viveiros de Castro, the new Marxist philosopher Kōhai Saitō, and Nietzsche, just to name a few. At stake in Connolly's intellectual endeavors is the production of truth for confronting an age of planetary wreckage. Professor William Connolly, thank you for joining me on Countersign. I was delighted to read your recent books, Climate Machines, Fascist Drives, and Truth, Resounding Events, Adventures of an Academic from the Working Class, published by Fordham. And also I've had the privilege of reading some drafts of your forthcoming book, Transfiguring Western Cosmology, Pagan Vitalities, Christian Settler Legacies, and Climate Wreckage, although the title of that may be adjusted in due course. Now, these texts that I've just mentioned are only a small part of a much larger body of work by an intellectual whose engagements with the world are so resoundingly formed in the farms and factory towns in which he grew up, and in a nation state, United States, that has moved through a golden age for some of its population and through to great disappointments and decay in many places. You were born, Bill, and grew up as the United States moved into an increasingly imperial position after the Second World War, and as it became the emblematic capitalist state and global superpower. The accompanying ebbs and flows of left and right politics, Christianity and secular creeds, liberalism and pluralism, capitalism and its decline, the working class family, sexual liberation and new gender identities, and the fascism that has emerged alongside the indelible evidence of climate and planetary wreckage are just some of the movements of thought and experience that you have chronicled and helped us to think through. There is rather a lot here because you have thought, taught, and done so much. I see in your engagements with the climate crisis and ecological catastrophe a thinker who is working with multiple temporalities, and I think this is something we'll come to in our discussion, and explaining the political as variously woven, torn, and sutured with insights drawn from your own life. And for that reason, I think I would like to make contact with some of these biographical elements. Now, you're a scholar who was made in Flint, Michigan, and other places too, no doubt. And you were born before a single human-made atomic explosion had occurred. And now you stare into an abyss, that of the Anthropocene, which is very likely to be determined by geologists as commencing when the trace of radioactive materials across the planet can be detected. This also means that you have lived through the Cold War and the threat of nuclear weapons. This latter threat, too, has returned. While we will go on to discuss the destruction of many forms of being, life and non-life, shall we start on a positive note? What has been the single most important positive development, do you think, in your lifetime? Is it immutable? And what must we do to protect it?
Thank you. Thanks for having me on Countersign. You're right, of course, that those very early experiences do resound in my thinking about today. And I include the Cold War. I include the anti-Vietnam War movements that I participated in with many others. And also McCarthyism. So McCarthyism was very close in terms of affecting my family and my next door neighbor who was beaten up in a factory the day after the House Un-American Activities Committee came to town. And so that forms a certain kind of sense that I revert to from time to time when I worry about American fascism. The first one that comes to mind is what happened in the middle and late 60s, during these various new left and anti-war movements and anti-racist movements, when a new kind of a pluralism started to emerge in the interconnected domains of, say, religion and race and gender practices and family life and sexualities. And it was much richer and more vibrant than the old kind of pluralism that was taught in the social sciences, interest group pluralism, where various economic interests contended with each other. So it opened a great civilizational possibility in terms of this diversity and the emergence of an ethos of engagement across these diversities. And it challenged both the closures of a territorial Christianity and the closures of a secularism that grew out of that. Of course, it created a great backlash that is still in motion. There wasn't a energetic economic egalitarianism attached to this pluralism. And so that helped to set in motion during a period of deindustrialization that hit in the United States, the Midwest especially, it helped to set in motion these reactions. That is the first of the crystallizations that I could talk about as being on this positive.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a really important set of movements that you identify, and I think also very important to recall the impact of McCarthyism and the anti-Vietnam protests in your own political and intellectual development. And the last point you made about the failure of various forms of pluralist and identitarian movements to at the same time address economic inequalities, that the politics of various identities didn't also move along, although there were exceptions to this, of course.
Right.
That it didn't address the question of economic injustice is a comment that I recall Patricia Williams in the first of these podcasts for Countersign I think made. So thanks for those reflections. And so we are currently moving, rapidly along to the present week. In fact, the 20th of March, just a few days ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued its sixth assessment report. And I'll just quote a few lines from it. It says, "Widespread and rapid changes in the atmosphere, ocean, cryosphere, and biosphere have occurred. Human-caused climate change is already affecting many weather and climate extremes in every region across the globe. This has led to widespread adverse impacts and related losses and damages to nature and people." And very significantly, they say, "Vulnerable communities who have historically contributed the least to current climate change are disproportionately affected," end of quote. Now, you've been tracking these developments in several of your recent books. As the impacts of climate change have become more certain, many nation states, including the United States, have taken a fascist political turn with belligerent denialism and a fortress mentality. What do you see as the roots of this shift to the political right? Just as the world needs to see cooperation, responsibility, and redistribution of resources.
Yeah, well, the United States, as I'm sure you know, has been probably the biggest center of climate denialism in a country that until very recently was the site of the most CO2 and methane emissions and deforestation and so forth. Now it's joined by others. And so I think that what we have is a combination. And the combination is a combination of virulent climate denialism joined to a tradition, wider tradition of climate casualism. Mm-hmm. And climate casualism has prevailed in the academy. Mm-hmm. There's a recognition there's climate change, but it's always, the recognition is usually 5 to 10 years behind. And I will say that the geologists that I've been studying were very critical of the earlier reports of the IPCC, because the IPCC was going through computer analyses, but it didn't take into account sufficiently the dynamism of the intersections between various, let's say, capitalist CO2 and methane emissions, and then the planetary amplifiers that they set into motion. Mm-hmm. And those amplifiers greatly make that the result is much larger than the initial trigger. And by the way, the amplifiers also redistribute the effects to tropical and polar areas, so that for a long time, the states in the temperate zones, capitalist states, emitted the most triggers and received the fewest effects, and were very, very innocent about how they were distributing these effects around. I think that innocence is still operative in the academy to a great extent, so that when I go to some meetings in the humanities and so forth, someone will say, "I don't think we need to hear anything from the geologists. I don't think we need to hear too much from the neuroscientists. We have our own understandings," and so forth. And of course, now those things are debated, but they weren't so debated for a long time. So the sources of denialism in the States are white evangelical religious creeds that say the human beings will not change climate. God changes climate. Mm-hmm. And then that's one source. And then it's joined to a neoliberal tradition that pretends that it can, increasingly pretends that it can do anything it wants in terms of finding new sources of oil, like in the Alaska willow fields, and that these that will not issue disastrous consequences. So the political coalition between the white evangelicals and white neoliberal donor class has been potent mm-hmm. and has been extremely destructive. The casualists are people who feel very good about themselves because they have they're not denialists. The denialism actually makes the casualists more casual than they otherwise might be. And they have for years, this is changing fast, but late, they have for years warned people like the geologists I admire and me and others that we're alarmists. We're alarmists. Mm-hmm. We're catastrophists. We're playing into the right wing because it was always coming up with a new catastrophe, election, fake election, white replacement theory, vaccinations as implants to trace you and so forth. They've said, don't be such an alarmist. What I want to say back, and I have been saying, and I am saying again in this new book, is there's a difference between catastrophism and catastrophism.
Mm-hmm.
Catastrophism covers up the potential catastrophes that we face today. It's a covering operation. And catastrophism is the acknowledgement that we're in a perilous state in which the dangers of potential catastrophes are nuclear holocaust, they are climate wreckage, and they are fascism. And those dangers are intercoded. I am a self-described catastrophist now, pursuing these potentials and trying not to allow people who engage these dangers to become either too resigned or too nihilistic as they confront the realities.
That's really important. That's a very important point about climate casualism. And how you meet this accusation of catastrophism and articulate why it is urgent that the catastrophes that are clearly upon us need to be addressed. Now, we'll come to the specific philosophical and political interlocutors in your work. But before I do that, I wanted to draw the sort of broader brush that your work and writings in political theory and political philosophy also spanned a period from in the 1960s and 1970s where there was a movement from Marxism to post-Marxism, where a new left emerges after 1968, particularly in the North Atlantic. But this can also be mapped on to decolonial movements and the emergence of new histories, new political theories from the recently decolonized part of the world. Where do you position yourself in these movements of thinking?
Yeah, I've gone through various mutations. I would say that in the growing up, as the son of a factory worker who worked on the assembly line and who also was the president of his local, who loved his local and hated his work.
And we should say local union, because in some parts of the world, local means pub.
Okay. He was also a guy who enjoyed the pub. Yes, local union, the president of his local union. And so that when I went to graduate school and started reading the early Marx manuscripts, it was as if it was a description of my family life and the modes of alienation and so forth. And so I folded those understandings of alienation of the worker from life and from the product of the work into my own thinking during that period. What happened beginning in the 70s was the emergence of an Althusserian problematic that I found myself much less attracted to. I thought it was authoritarian. Its structural determinations were too coarse and crude, and I never really, and especially now, could buy the idea of Althusser that it's always the economy in the last instance. Take a look at the Mayan civilization in 900s, for example, to see if that's what he would say, or our circumstances today. So third, there have been people like Jason Moore, Mike Davis, and most recently for me, Kohei Sato, who has been exposing us to the Marx after 1868. Mm-hmm. And I studied really the Marx up until 1865, and I studied the critique of the Gotha program and saw Prometheanism in it, saw productivism in it, saw domination of the earth in it. But according to Kohei, Marx's notebooks after 68 are taking a dramatic turn. But I'm also thinking about the capacity or the possibility and the ecological left for a certain kind of rapprochement between this version of Marx and the kind of ecological work that other people have been doing.
No, that's really helpful that you draw attention to Kohei Sato, because I think one of the points that he has made in his work and in the return to Marx's notebooks, etc., is to sort of de-emphasize the need for continuous progressive development and economic growth, as it were. And so there's been an emphasis, in a sense, on degrowth. And degrowth, of course, has been quite a fundamental aspect of how we need to adjust social and economic and political life to the new climate catastrophes.
Right. What I would say is that the Marx that he delineates has broken with some of the other things that people have attributed to Marx, but that the notion of planetary gradualism still seems to stay there. I don't blame Marx for that. Mm-hmm. I blame us for it if we continue to hold that view, the notion of the planet, species processes, climate, geological processes, ocean processes, polar states change only very, very slowly. That was the dominant notion in geology from Darwin until at least the middle 1980s, where they had the geological revolution and talk about many periods of climate volatility. My fear is that a lot of the humanities and social sciences still haven't caught up with this revolution in the earth sciences, the geological sciences. And why are they important? Well, they're important because radical, rapid changes can teach us about how triggers create these amplifiers or planetary amplifiers that can change things faster. For example, one geologist says, let's just study the Eemian period, which was 130,000 years ago. No human activity was involved, but the Earth got much hotter than it is supposed to get during the peak of the Anthropocene, and all kinds of processes were activated once the initial planetary triggers opened the door. Then other processes were and his theory is that what happened was that the initial heating released massive methane formations that heated the planet much more, so that and made the sea level rise about 20 feet. Mm-hmm. So his view, and the view that I embrace, is that we have to come to terms with some of the volatile moments in planetary history to understand the Anthropocene, to understand how climate wreckage is working and might work today.
Absolutely. And we'll come to talking more about this.
Okay.
These volatilities. But I still want to just track intellectual influences, sure, and theoretical interlocutors. And of course, Deleuze and Guattari have played an important role in your thinking, especially in helping you to distinguish between major and minor thinkers. I think for the for our listeners who are not so familiar with Deleuze and Guattari or this distinction of major and minor thinking, I think it would be useful if you could just give us a brief outline, and then we can go on to talk about some of the examples of the major and minor thinkers.
Yeah, Deleuze and Guattari kind of hit me early in the 90s when I was just beginning to break with my own assumptions of human exceptionalism and planetary gradualism. So all those things were coming around together. In A Thousand Plateaus, they will talk about rhizomes, and a rhizome is a series of connections between heterogeneous entities of very different kinds and sorts that bring new things into being. And so they would talk about, and they did talk about in the 1980s, viral crossings, viral species crossings of the sort that we now think about crossing from say birds to pangolins to human beings, with a kind of a creative resonances at each moment of the crossing to make the new infusion possible. They talked about things like the difference between smooth space and striated space, so that you would say that most territories are striated with different divisions and rulings and modes of sovereignty. And then you could say that atmospheres and oceans and other formations are more smooth spaces, but they can be striated. And one of the things I think you've been thinking about is the striation of the Indian Ocean. And if we use Deleuzian terms, by the use of Australia, of this small island of Nauru, to imprison and to hold migrants, some of whom are climate migrants, not all of whom, but some of whom, they're climate and civil war migrants and so forth. Deleuze and Guattari open the door to reflections that can allow people like us who are in the human sciences and the humanities to extend our notion of what our intellectual life has to be, what it is like for an intellectual to follow a problem wherever it takes them, even if you have to become amateurish in your forays into geology, virology, into species evolution. So to me, that was kind of an inspiration of Deleuze and Guattari, even though they themselves in the 1980s were not focusing on climate. They, and especially Deleuze, make this kind of almost humorous and crude division between the minor and the major theories. And the minor theories are mostly indebted to European paganism. And so they also think that that allows them to make crossings with various indigenous traditions in the Americas and so forth. And the minor traditions were suppressed, but they were not totally destroyed. So the minor traditions would include people like Sophocles and Lucretius and Epicurus, later Kafka, and certainly Nietzsche. Nietzsche would be at the center of it, because Nietzsche is the 19th century thinker who insisted that the planet was not didn't go through merely gradual changes. It went through very rapid and volatile changes as well. And so you could see how Sophocles could go there, because these plagues that start off some of his plays are oftentimes coordinated with volcanoes and other things, because we now know that the Greek archipelago sits at the site of three tectonic plates intersecting with one another from north, east, and west, and creating huge earthquakes, one of which we've just seen recently. Now, these are all relevant to climate change, too. Okay, so the major traditions are people like Augustine and Kant and Hegel and Rawls and Habermas, that much more oriented to notions of sovereignty. They might disagree with each other a lot, and much less willing to extend beyond sociocentric notions of how life is formed and how societies operate, much more oriented to human exceptionalism. Some of them will be secularists, like John Stuart Mill, and others will be tied to some version or other of Christianity. What Deleuze and Guattari wanted to do was to keep that minor-major debate alive and to take more or less one side of it, because they thought the debate had been muted. And it had been muted by a series of conquests of what became European pagans, and then, you know, the conquest of the Americas did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll come to talk more about pagans and paganism, which features quite strongly in your current work. But just to say a little bit more about the sociocentric, I think that would be useful to just to hear a little bit more about your critique of the sociocentric, and also just to keep in mind that for you, just like Deleuze and Guattari, the debate is important. So you continue to engage with Augustine, for example, yes. And other so-called major thinkers in the Deleuze and Guattari paradigm. So just to say, you know, how that debate is also productive for you. And then thirdly, if we can also just very quickly focus on what I thought was a wonderful discussion in the book Climate Machines of Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, because I think what you say about the circumstances under which Mary Shelley came to write Frankenstein, in fact, the planetary climactic conditions under which she wrote it, I think are fascinating.
Yes.
So if you can go back to just saying a couple of things about sociocentrism.
Yeah. Well, whenever I become harshly critical of something, it's usually because I used to be it. But sociocentrism is kind of anchored in Kant's division of the faculties. A sociocentric thinker is one who thinks that the fundamental causes of troubles and positive things in a, let's say, a state are anchored in social processes themselves and never anchored into sharp exchanges between human social processes and non-human processes of multiple sorts, including plagues. Sophocles' plays often start with a plague. A lot of 20th century readers of those plays treated the plague as symbolic. No, those were plagues. And Athens was hit by plagues. And one of the things that sociocentric thinkers do is to act as if we have eliminated plagues. Now, all of us know today that we haven't. But that was a very common theme. The Little Ice Age, when Europe invaded the Americas, in the North America especially, the Little Ice Age had a profound effect on what they could do and how the troubles they ran into, as it did on Amerindian peoples. But the category of the Little Ice Age was not available to the invaders.
Mm-hmm.
They assumed that the climate coordinated with latitude. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. Over and over and over again, Rome went through a period of the climate optimum, which helped and supported, didn't cause, because we don't want crude notions of causality, didn't cause the growth of the Roman Empire, but contributed to it as a background set of elements. That climate optimum disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
In the 500s, where you had antique Little Ice Age, and that contributed. And where did that come from? I got my hands out here. I'm sorry, it doesn't show. Where did that come from? Well, we now know that the antique Little Ice Age was started by two huge volcanoes in the south of Africa, and that contributed to the decomposition of the Roman Empire. And it also, for reasons that are very complicated, helped to promote the latest plague, because the cold conditions, I'm being too crude here, but the cold conditions compelled the rats to emerge from their various hiding places and mm-hmm. so forth. The infections grew. So another plague, the Justinian plague. Now, over and over and over again, sociocentrism is inadequate. Now, why do people want it? I think because they like to think of a horizon of smoothness, mm-hmm. possible horizon of smoothness. But those of us in the minor tradition don't think that way. I mean, I used to think that way, I'm sure. But those of us in the minor tradition, we think we'll periodically have to come to terms yeah. with that which moves from the outside to the inside and has pervasive consequences, and then the inside responds back.
Yes.
But I think the major minor debate is a very productive debate, because those of us who are impressed with the minor tradition, we might not take everything from it, but we might draw some positive sustenance from this or that in the major tradition. For example, think about how Kant thought of gymnastics that help the students that he was teaching to recognize the moral law. Well, in the minor tradition, we would treat those gymnastics as things that help to acculturate people to this or that way of being, rather than to carry the universal moral law into a populace. Now, I'll get to the thing about Mary Shelley, Frankenstein. I came to the Shelley book later in my life, of course. I mean, not of course, but I did. And what I found impressive is that she knew that something had gone haywire. There was no summer in Europe in 1816. A new plague broke out. There were starvations here and there. And there were also troubles in India, which I don't think she did know about during that same period. Her book was designed to, at its most obvious level, to make us less hubristic about our capacities to control the world, but it was also to make us alert to the various volatilities of earth processes in which she was facing. And so in that big chase of Frankenstein, I don't remember the details right now, but in the big chase of Frankenstein, they go through deserts, they go through Arctic ice mm-hmm. flows. She becomes very alert to the variety and the changeability of things.
That's really helpful. And of course, in the book Climate Machines, and also your forthcoming book, you continue this engagement with the minor thinkers, Mary Shelley, obviously being one of them, but also Hesiod, Ovid, Michael Serra, Viveros de Castro, Amitav Ghosh, just to name a few, and no doubt you could refer to them as our discussion continues. But you've already drawn attention to your focus on paganisms. And this focus on paganisms, I believe, comes from a very consistent aspect of your work. And in fact, the first book of yours that I read was as a graduate student in the mid-90s. It was Identity Difference, Democratic Negotiations of Political Paradox, which was first published in 1991. And I think in the early 2000s, it was reissued in a new edition. But I read the original one, and in it I was struck, and I think it was my first encounter with Manichaeans, that you're a political theorist focused on political theology, and indeed taking the theology in political theology seriously. And I see this current focus on paganisms as continuing that path. So what has driven your attentiveness to the divine and theological?
When I wrote a book called Why I'm Not a Secularist, but emphasizing in it that I'm also a non-theist. That is, I think that my non-theism is a contestable fundamental orientation to the world in various ways. I thought that the critiques of secularism wouldn't get any attention in theological circles, American, English, Danish theological circles, but maybe it would in amongst people who were writing about in the Rawlsians and Habermasian tradition. But I was totally wrong. A whole set of theologians were very actively, not necessarily agreeing with it and everything, but engaged and wanted to discuss it because they think that the separation of theology and philosophy has been a fundamental mistake. So you'll get people like Catherine Keller who wants to rethink Genesis, the book of Genesis, and retranslate it so that there was a bubbling deep when the limited God was working on things. And mm-hmm. She pursues that faith and also makes it so that pursuit makes it so that she wants to engage various minor and pagan traditions where she would see some affinities. They might see affinities across their differences in orientation. What I like about the kind of orientation is that she takes her theology to be contestable and she embraces it as her own. So she's looking for what I used to call, and I guess I would still call, agonistic respect across various mm-hmm. fundamentally different orientations in a world where all kinds of different religious and non-religious faiths are rubbing up against each other every day. Mm-hmm. And she herself embraces a Christian God who is limited. In that way, she's like William James, very much like William James in a pluralistic universe. And she begins to rethink Christian secular notions of time in Europe and America. People in some other traditions, let's say, not that anybody talks that way now today, but you remember people in the 90s saying, well, I'm post-metaphysical. Mm-hmm. Or no, I don't make any metaphysical assumptions. You do, but I don't. I just look at the world and describe and characterize it. Well, Keller and I don't think there are any people like that. Mm-hmm. We don't think there ever have been any people like that. And so we might diverge from one another in some of our fundamental orientations, but we both seek a certain kind of agonistic respect. She has a different phrase for it. It's a more beautiful phrase than mine. I can't think of it right now. I want to engage the theological traditions, A, and B, it helps me perhaps in my amateurish way to engage people like Sophocles and Hesiod with the multiple gods who were the personifications of the volatilities they recognized, and perhaps to engage people like William Apus in North America, the Pequot thinker, and in a secondary way, Aztecs, and through the work of De Castro, Amazonians, because I think that the minor traditions in Europe and those three traditions have things to say to each other across differences, but they've been blocked. It's too ambitious, but I would like to participate with others in taking the term pagan and kind of lifting it from, like queer theory has done in another domain, in lifting it to a positive or set of orientations that should be discussed and debated as part of public life and not demeaned and defiled before. Mm-hmm. So that's why in this new book, the Augustine chapter is so important to me, because it's the over 1,000-page book. It's called The City of God Against the Pagans. And the pagans are sick people. They are lewd people. They are crude people. They are people who should not be allowed to have a positive place in the world. He wouldn't kill them. Augustine would never kill them, but he would always use the necessities of history to to justify whatever happened to them. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to bore the reader with about 35 pages of discussing in detail Augustine's reading of pagans in Rome. And by the way, one of the people we talk about is Varro, this famous writer, but we don't have his texts. They have been destroyed. They were destroyed by anti-paganism. We have Augustine's quotations from, just to be, you know, problematic. When I read the quotations, I kind of like the guy.
Yeah.
And so that's what is going on in this book. And that's why I engage at the end Ghosh, because Ghosh is very taken with pagan traditions of multi-vitalities, he calls it. That is, non-human modes of agency of numerous and striving of numerous sorts that intersect and interact with each other and with us. Mm-hmm.
This is Amitav Ghosh's Nutmeg book that you're.
Yes. The Curse of the Nutmeg.
Yes. So I just want to hold on to a couple of the points you were making there, Bill. And firstly, the point about metaphysical thinkers, because one of the other things that, you know, you've described yourself as a process thinker.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the kind of image of truth that emerges from this process thinking. And I want to put in contact and to maybe just push you a little bit on this, that the metaphysics of various thinkers, and we can think of Marx here, and many others, as confronting the problem of how thought engages the world, how thought receives what to thinking would be perceived as an object in the world. And it usually does that through abstraction, through concepts, sometimes through mystification. And what we have in a lot of your interlocutors is also a set of new materialisms where materiality and the object itself has agency. And in the case of some thinkers, the object also is able to produce norms. Now, I'm quite interested in how you maintain an attentiveness to the metaphysical and the manner in which engaging the world must also be attentive to this question of philosophical method in relation to how the world is received by thinking. Of course, to come back, it is, in your case, process thinking as you characterize it. So maybe you can say a little bit more about that problem of method in the context of process thinking.
So a process thinker, I will say in a minute what I think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Process thinker does not give up on truth. But that's the way that some people will describe them, because process thinkers don't hold to the correspondence model of truth, in which you presuppose the subject-object relation and the world consists of objects, and truth is a correspondence to those objects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And because process thinkers such as Whitehead and James had already concluded that there are many more strivings and agencies in the world than human beings, so they have to be included in the attempts to come to terms with the world. And Whitehead would say that is why there is also real creativity in the world, not because there are certain agents that are creative, that are geniuses and creative, but because of resonances back and forth between two modes of striving of different sorts, and new things come into play. Nietzsche held that view too, although many people have failed to attributed to him. So truth now becomes an aspiration whereby you, it's a thing of this world. It's not tied to an eternal God, because Whitehead has a God, but it's not eternal. It's a God who's in time rather than above time. It's not a God who invented time from scratch. That's, therefore, it's not Augustinian God. And so truth is the attempt, the pursuit of truth is the attempt to keep, to establish and show consonances or coherences amongst multiple elements as they get configured into a specific situation. And so truth is a constant aspiration. And you were often faced the situation where you don't think you have the complete truth. For Whitehead, for Foucault, although Foucault was more sociocentric than I wished he had been, for Deleuze and Guattari, for Michel Serre, for Latour, truth is a pursuit in which you seek coherence between multiple elements in a world that is not neatly divided into subjects, human beings, and objects. Mm-hmm. And that's what De Castro is in his work on Amazonians is calling the game changer. The Amazonians think not of world of subjects and objects, but of multiple subjectivities that are intersecting and interacting with one another, human, non-human, and various sorts. Does it go all the way down to quantum processes? Well, I'm kind of indebted to the quantum theorist Carlo Rovelli, who says, I am not a panpsychist or pan-experientialist, but I do say that every entity in its as it proceeds through the world enters into periods of heightened sensitivity where new changes occur. So I will talk about subjects and forces, and I don't know. That's always a debate with people about Whitehead on that score, but that's where I go, and I agree with Rovelli on it. And my guess is that both Whitehead and Rovelli came rethinking issues after engaging quantum theory, because Whitehead said, "I hope this is not too great a diversion." Whitehead said, at the end of the 19th century, all of us physicists and philosophers in England thought that we only had to change a couple little things here and there, tighten the screws here and there, and Newtonianism would be established as the theory that corresponds to the world as it is. And then he said, and then all hell broke loose. Mm-hmm. All hell broke loose. And it was quantum theory that he worked with. And that's why I'm kind of fascinated with Carlo Rovelli today, and especially his little book called Helgoland. Mm-hmm. So truth now becomes a thing of this world. It's composed of coherence between multiple elements. And oftentimes you know that some of the elements are out of sync with the others in your theory. And you have to, you may not have to start again, but you have to reopen the doors of receptivity and thinking. So that's why these thinkers are so much into creative thinking and moments of almost mindfulness where you're responsive to that which has been outside your purview and understanding to date.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I don't go with Whitehead all the way. I'm closer to Nietzsche and Deleuze and Guattari, but they're very close to him, except they think the world is the planet is a rockier place than he thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that's really helpful. One of the other aspects of connecting with this mindfulness and the attentiveness to modes of striving is about the normative implications of this knowledge. So a much more open image of truth is introduced to us and elaborated by you and other minor thinkers. But sometimes I worry that we're also coexisting in models of knowledge where there is a stronger major idea of normativity and of truth. So I was wondering how you help the minor mode to make contact with that major universe, if you like, of normativity.
Yeah. Yes. Well, the first thing is right now, by your question, kind of pulled back to the kind of long-term debate that I've had with Charles Taylor, who is also became a friend. So Charles Taylor would have a more teleological vision of the world, in which it would be tied to notions of realization and notions of commonality and community and so forth. And he concluded that that Foucault, in '90s, he concluded this, didn't have a notion of subject or truth or purpose in the world, and therefore he had nihilistic possibilities. But what many of us have tried to do over the decades is to, as Taylor comes to terms with the contestability of his own orientation to divinity, to see that we're not unbelievers. We have a vision of our own that we also think is contestable, and we wanted to put it into play in the world. What I found strangely is some of the people who have these teleological finalist visions are more open in the last analysis to debating and discussing with us and to mutual modifications than people in the Kantian tradition are, who have, say, it's all set. What we have to do is we have to show where the transcendental arguments of a Kantian go wrong, and then not to say now all hell breaks loose, but to pursue an ethic and an ethos of cultivation from that point on. And that's what we strive to do. I think the late Foucault is a model, actually, for this, but others, Derrida and others, have done similar things, perhaps. That debate is not going to disappear. The question is how to transform it so it isn't this voice of superiority and that voice of inferiority. That is the resurrection of pagan voices in the world of today, especially in the world of rapid climate change. Mm-hmm. My sense is that Aztecs had a much greater sense of the volatility of the world than Kantians and than Rawlsians. I mean, you think about how sociocentric Rawls was all the way through his work. What we're trying to do is to break the pattern of superiority to inferiority and open up the pattern of agonistic respect amongst people who rub shoulders together and have different orientations.
Well, Bill, you've given us a lot to think about there, about, and I think you've really beautifully elaborated what can be gathered from pagan thinking for the challenges of the Anthropocene. Now, a final question. What do you think are the most indispensable insights from the humanities for confronting and surviving our turbulent times? And what matters do we need to continue to work on? And indeed, what are you going to continue working on?
I kind of think of that as a two-part question. First, what do the humanities desperately need to learn? And then secondly, what could people in, let's say, geology or in these other fields, and in my own thinking, learn from the humanities at their best? What I would like to just note for a moment is that you can't live today, and really in the past, within the orbit of cultural internalism or sociocentrism. And so that today we live in a situation where impersonal circuits of planetary imperialism are in play. Where, to give one example, you have, I don't know if I gave the El Nino example. Did I already give
it? No, you haven't. Yeah, okay. You haven't.
So capitalist temperate zone states will create emissions that intensify and render more durable El Ninos in the Pacific. That, in ways that are hard for people to explain fully, dilutes and weakens the trade winds flowing east and it creates droughts, and it can create monsoon interruptions in India and China. These are devastating effects that are so that the amplifier here are the winds, planetary winds, impersonal processes that distribute them to different areas of the world. It's a form of imperialism. And once it becomes conscious, it's a form of conscious imperialism. And there are many, many things like that. The collapse of the Thwaite Glacier, which is could well happen in the West Antarctic, in the most devastating case, would increase sea levels by 10 feet. Now, that hits Sri Lanka, that hits Somali, that hits Bangladesh. And so it's distributed unevenly across the world. So as humanists, we can't simply think about the internal humanist processes anymore, or we're missing what's happening in the world that we participate in. As intellectuals, we have to stretch ourselves out and become participate maybe in amateurish ways in virology and thinking about bacterial flows and thinking about impersonal planetary processes. There are other such things that affect the poles and so forth. Then what to learn from the humanities? Well, there are a couple of things that seem utterly crucial. The first is the way that humanistic thinking can promote mindfulness and open you up to new receptivities of exploration as part of the exploration. And the second is that the way that humanists can dramatize processes underway that geologists and maybe people like me are talking about in ways that don't insinuate itself into the soul enough. And that's why I like Amitav Ghosh so much. That's why I like the book, The Nightmare's Curse. It starts off with a dramatic scene in Banda Island in 1621 and proceeds from there to talk about the horrendous effects on peoples and climate of settler societies. So I don't think that I'm adequate to the question that you have posed, but those are two things that I think that are essential from the humanities once it really moves, once they really move beyond cultural internalism.
Okay. Well, Bill, this has been wonderful. It's been a great pleasure for me to meet you while I'm visiting at Johns Hopkins. And I want to recall that in, I think, 1997, when I was a confused young man trying to work out whether to pursue a career in law or in academia, I saw you give a plenary lecture at the ANU in Canberra. And I thought, wow, you know, look at how this man is thinking, receiving questions, responding to them. And it was a moment of great inspiration that pushed me down an academic path. So it's been a great pleasure to meet you here again in the United States, and also to have you on Countersign. I'm really excited to read all of the new book once it's out, and to continue discussions with you. So thank you so much for your time, Bill.
Thanks so much for having me. You can think of me as a confused older man. Nonetheless, it's just pursuing these issues and tasks. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Countersign. Thank you for joining me. For more information, please visit countersignisapodcast.com.